Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I am Yada. It's my pleasure to be with you on this Shabbat. I see that we have Larry and JB. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Good. Well, it was
been a long week.
Nice to have it has a break. Been a long week. Yeah, it has been a long
loving
week.
The study on Yahu Kanan 3, by the way. I'm a couple days behind. I still haven't finished it, but man, has that been good stuff.
You know, the insights we have been able to glean, and now we've spent 2 weeks. Kirk and I have spent 2 weeks on Yahu Kanan 3 up to about the 18th verse. Now, we started it at the end of Yahu Kanan 2 and went through it for the specific reason of showing that if you have an open mind, if you're willing to invest the time, if you consider what the words actually say, if you make connections to the word of Yahweh in the Torah and prophets, that you can learn an enormous amount, and that most often the religious understanding of whatever was cited out of context, in context, is completely negated. And so I thoroughly enjoy the time with Kirk, but that has been one of the most enlightening reviews that I have done in a very long time. Everything from Yosha being Torah observant, from Yosha saying, I don't want merchants, I don't want money making, I don't want money, period, to be part of my house. Get it out of here. To him in town for Passover, to him predicating everything on Passover, to him being a profoundly insightful teacher, to Nicodemus being misnamed and an absolute religious nincompoop, to Yosha treating him like a religious nincompoop and saying, you know, you're just an idiot. What is it about you? You can't figure this out. And I'm even talking to you about
you
the mundane.
Call yourself
and you
a teacher.
Yeah, you call yourself a teacher, and you don't even know where to look for the family of God. I mean, he is giving them him the riot act. It's amazing in all of that. And then he emphasizes not only the family of God and where to look for the family of God, and equates himself to Moshe lifting up the brazen serpent on the pole as a remedy for venom, that which paralyzes and kills. But he also says, I will not trust my witness to men. I know men. And there is no way that I'm ever going to trust my witness to men. Just every aspect of it. And then he goes through the process of the difference between being physical and mortal and being spiritual and immortal, and how the relationship, the family of God, precedes everlasting life, and everlasting life precedes salvation, and it's in that order. I thought that it was one of the most brilliant things, and that, you know, I've taken the time to consider, and every time we went over it, we learned something new. Now, there is something that pertains here to the discussion that has, I'm not even sure it's a discussion because it hasn't been all that civil, about the exemption that is presented in Devarim on food. And that is that there are aspects of the of Matanya Mark, which is really Shimon Kefesh, Luke, which is hearsay, but it's I think he did the best he could do with the sources he had. He just got things out of order. And Yahu Kanan, who I think whose original copy would while not inerrant, would have been extraordinarily valuable, but has been copy edited a lot. But nonetheless, there are still, from those four sources, things that we can learn. Absolutely, unequivocally, things that we can learn by the example and the testimony of the physical incarnation of Yahweh's testimony. And Yahweh Kanan 3 is a great example of that. And I think, for the most part, when we're dealing with Yosha's testimony, so long as it's been translated accurately two times over from Hebrew to Greek, Greek to English, and maintained somewhat credibly, great value to it. While I've never been one to overemphasize the importance of Yosha, because he is simply a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, Yahweh taking human form and talking to us, what he has to say is valuable. And my personal interest has always been, and I guess the thing I would love most to do is to verify my presumption, which has consistently been affirmed in everything I have done thus far, that nothing Yosha said was additive to the Torah and prophets, that everything he said can be gleaned from the Torah and prophets, and that everything he said is consistent with the Torah and prophets. So what do you all think about kind of that recap of what Kirk and I have been discussing and that summation of Yahweh Kanan 3 and Yosha's testimony?
I think it's important because probably Yahweh Kanan 3:16 is the most misquoted passage ever heard.
Yeah, and in context, it's impossible to derive the Christian mythos of believe in Jesus and you'll be saved. In fact, the next line...
That's why it's never cited in context.
Yeah, the next line actually tells you that it's the personal and proper name. And the personal and proper name is Yahweh's personal and proper name. You know, it's Yahweh saving. And not one of them gets that. And not one of them understands what came before, where he was talking about being born and the family of God. He began by, Nicodemus wanted to know how to be saved. And Yosha said, hey, it's all about being born spiritually into the covenant family. In other words, Yosha's explanation is the same that we have come to by studying the Torah. I think that's a valuable affirmation. It's a wonderful opportunity to find out that what we have derived by studying the Torah is consistent with Yosha's testimony.
I think IQ's getting it too. I noticed.
Yeah, we're actually having
IQ's getting on board there.
In fact, he just sent me another email. I haven't had a chance to respond to it, but it's again about the uniqueness of the Jews and. First time ever when, I have mentioned to him several times that that the testimony of Yahweh in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is 100% consistent. It's accurate scientifically, accurate historically, has no contradictions, and it's filled with accurate prophecies. He proves that he's God. And his testimony, IQ knows, is wholly different than that of the Quran. They're the antithesis of one another. Like God,
he's starting to understand. It's also different from Christianity.
Right, and this was the first time, that he understood that Paul was the founder of Christianity.
I was happy to hear that, by the way.
And that Paul absolutely and unequivocally contradicted and corrupted what Yosha had said.
He's the moral equivalent of Muhammad, and that's what he is.
Yeah, he is the moral equivalent of Muhammad. Yeah. In fact, we talked today about, somebody asked, why would Muhammad present? I've forgotten what the context was, but it was, why would there be such anti-Semitism? In the Quran, it wasn't actually in Shattering Myths. I did a an hour show, hour and a half show, right after Shattering Myths with Louis Free today. And during that show, and he is a rabbinic Jew. He has he's a very popular show. It's the host name is Louis Free, and he is a rabbinic Jew. And we were talking today about, you know, why was the testimony of Muhammad so anti-Semitic? And you know, I explained that he, like Paul, had admitted that they were demon-possessed, which means they're going to convey the desires, the wishes of the goals, the motivations of the adversary, HaSatan. And that you know, Yahweh's chosen people were his witnesses, and you see in Paul the same thing you see in Muhammad, is a demonic influence that is trying to undermine and destroy that which God loves most, his chosen people. So there is definitely an adversary, and you know, that's the root of it. And IQ made great progress today. I even think Louis Free made great progress. Whether he has me back after I assailed rabbinic Judaism in addition to Christianity and Islam, as opposed to the old days when I was just assailing Islam, we'll see. But his eyes were certainly opened. I want to briefly deal with an email that I thought was inappropriate. I'm going to read the email exactly as it was sent to me. I'm going to tell you why I think the email is inappropriate. And from that point, we have a choice. And I'm going to let you guys actually make that choice. And those who wish to chime in on the chat room, you're welcome to do so as well. The choice is going to be that we can go through, once again, the translation that I did of the passage that provides the exemption, and examine every word, every pronoun, every conjunction, every stem, every mood, every aspect of it, and I will give you the full range of what the possibilities are. Or we can turn to, James has a, well, began with an alternative view on it. I think, James, you've now moved to, you think that that both of our positions are probably valid. And we can,
I think there's a good argument for that.
Yeah, you know. It's
one of those, the more I consider the deeper things got, the more interesting it got in.
Yeah,
you know, where it started off is I kind of differed, and I got, because I could see your view and I got where you were coming from, but this kind of made a little more sense. Then it was all sort of like, well, what about this? And
the more you think about it, and ultimately, when you first had your idea, and when we can talk about this tonight, it, as with our difference on Passover, the thing that is the ultimate deal maker for me, because the way that the timing on Passover with matzah is presented, and the way this is presented, you could come up with either application, either inference from the statement. But what I used as my tiebreaker is Yosha's example. Yosha's example with Passover is consistent with my timing. Yosha's statements regarding food are consistent with the way that I rendered this this passage. So that's always my tiebreaker, and you know, while I am a, and we are all dismissive of Paul's and his pal's contribution to the Christian New Testament, and we're completely dismissive of a New Testament, Yosha's words and deeds matter. And while there is a possibility that some of the things that he said, like, you know, John 8, where he's talking, you know, with the adulterous woman, were contrived, you know, it's not all contrived. We benefit by knowing what he, if we didn't know what he said and did, I'm going to tell you, I don't think any of us is smart enough we'd have figured it out.
Yeah, I would add to that. Like this one, this time our difference was on, yeah, I did really just not look at Yahusha's comments there. But in regard to the timing of Passover, I think it was more just what we looked at in terms of Yahweh's fulfillment. I looked at in terms of when Yahweh was the Passover lamb, and you were going by more when he celebrated the Passover. And
yeah,
so that
but
he was kind of
yeah, he was the Passover lamb, and he celebrated Passover on the same day.
That's correct.
Yeah, on the same day, and that day started the evening before, which is why I looked at Yosha's example. And by the way, I think you can tell by my tone and by James's tone that when we come to different understandings on something, we almost always end up saying, I don't find any fault in your position. Like in James's position, I find no fault in his position. I think it is very well researched, very well stated, very well reasoned, and presented. And James didn't find any fault in my position, my translations, my rendering, my thinking. Both are permissible. And I think that we both are enriched by the discussion. The same thing was true with what turned out to be a non-disagreement, really, in this passage on food. We ended up with a really pretty close to the same position by the end.
Yeah,
so we can do that.
When there are places in Yahweh's word where it is a bit ambiguous, and it's that way for a reason, because he does want us doing exactly what we're doing right here,
right,
which is discussing it, talking about it, thinking about it,
correct,
delving into it.
As opposed to obeying it blindly, dumbly, thoughtlessly. You know, if he gave us perfect,
exactly,
clear instructions on everything associated with Passover that we could do at a particular time, and we would be have eternal life if we just did step by step what he said in a clear, succinct, unambiguous way, you know, there'd be a lot more people who would be immortal who we wouldn't want to spend, and Yahweh wouldn't want in heaven. We wouldn't want to spend time with him,
yeah,
either. So there's a reason that you have to be thoughtful about this this whole thing. So we can do that. I think that would be a good thing to do. Or the other option I was going to put out there is that I am thrilled with this, the process of and the thought of translating and pondering the Aaronic enlightened free will blessing that is provided in Numbers in Bamidbar, and I have not made an attempt to translate it. And I thought it might be interesting, since this was a criticism of my translating and the credibility of my translating, to take me out of the equation, but just to bring you all up to speed so that you can actually experience what I do when I translate, what we have to work with, and what the options are, and then just go word by word and say, how do we think we should render this? And we can use the Aaronic blessing and Numbers as an example of, on the fly, how do we translate? You know, what are our options?
Can I cast my vote now? Because this sounds like fun.
Yeah.
I am all for this.
Yeah. All right. So let me read the email that I thought was especially demeaning, counterproductive, inappropriate. It said, it begins, and the beginning here does not apply to me because this was not my argument, and I think it's a pretty thin argument. I'm really tired of this repeated inaccuracy, so we're copying an attitude right now, about women on their period. I already pointed this out, but no one listened, and the myth continues to be perpetrated. The verses do not, capital N, capital O, capital T, say that the woman has to leave the tent. They say not to have sex with her during her period. The Talmud says that she has to be put out of the tent, among many other rules. Does anybody double-check this stuff anymore? So she's in an argument. And by the way, the name of the person, I do not know. I do not want to know. I have not called out this person by name. I do not know and don't want to know in this case. So it appears to me that she is in a battle with Larry over this, and she's been out of shape over it. And sometimes what you need to do is just pick your battles. This is probably not a good battle to fight. That's my opinion. Now, this is the second. So here's the second paragraph. And by the way, in the first paragraph, okay, let's just say that that it is the that you can't have sex with your wife during her period. Now, my guess is that every single one of us has violated that at some point. Now, beyond that...
Well, first of all, it doesn't say that. It says anyone who touches her. So,
right.
Yeah, we've all violated it, period.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, touches her. Yeah, that's right. Touch. So, yeah, so...
it's not sex, so that was,
I will,
see,
yeah,
that was
I will
twisting
guarantee
right
you,
away.
I guarantee we've all violated it. The point
yeah.
is, there are hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds, including the thing that James originally thought that this passage in the Devarim was addressing on the butchering and eating of food, where you're prescribed to bring the animal that you're going to butcher to the tent of the witness, and you have the lowy, you know, bless it and sprinkle the blood and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. None of us do that. There are hundreds upon hundreds of things that the Torah says that we do not do, that we cannot do. There's nothing in the Torah we can't learn from. And so it doesn't matter what example you give. For example, don't touch a woman who's on her period. And we all violate it. There is always something we can learn, no matter what is being said, while there are hundreds of examples of things we cannot do. And so to be fixated on saying that the pork thing is my, you know, my litmus test, boy, I'm just never going to have my lips touch swine, and focus on it, and somehow almost ritualize the experience of being Torah observant by not eating pork is hypocritical when you consider all the other things that we do. So that's my response to the first paragraph. And I'm really sick and tired and inaccuracy the like. And even here where it says, and not to have sex with her during her period, where it says don't touch her during her period, that's not helpful. To add inaccuracy to inaccuracy and take the tone. Now, she then turns to me. She said, I ran CW's grammar explanation by five different unrelated Hebrew scholars, both religious and secular. When I, by the way, when I see that kind of a thing, now I don't know this individual, but when I hear that somebody did something to five different people, secular and religious, and I wonder how many secular Hebrew scholars there really are. I mean, can you imagine? Why would you be a secular Hebrew scholar? I mean, the only Hebrew we're interested in.
Well, there are a lot of linguistics professors who know many, many, many languages.
But they wouldn't be a Hebrew scholar if they were just a linguistic expert.
Yeah.
They would be a linguistics scholar.
Yeah, there's
and
really not a
of,
reason to become a scholar of the Hebrew language.
No. I mean,
although there are a lot of secular Jews who speak Hebrew.
Who
the majority
speak,
of
but,
Jews in the world today
understand.
Are secular.
Modern Hebrew, Babylonian Hebrew, pointed Masoretic Hebrew, and the text of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms are they're a different animal.
Oh, yeah. Very
They different. Are a different animal. You can be an English scholar today and not be prepared to analyze the well, even before Shakespeare, if you look at the English that the first Wycliffe translation was done.
The original Anglo-Saxon
language. Yeah, the Anglo-Saxon derivative. I mean, the difference between the text of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms in the original alphabet, and this migration to modern Hebrew via the Masoretic vowel pointing system are a far greater difference than modern English is from the Anglo-Saxon of Wycliffe.
Yeah, it's about like the difference between Latin and the Latin-derived languages of today, Spanish, Italian. You know, they're all Latin-derived languages, but they're nothing like Latin.
So if you are a religious scholar on Hebrew, by the way, I think this is an exaggeration. I do know. I'm not going to test for it. I just think it's an exaggeration, the five. And I don't think there is such a thing, a beast today, as a secular Hebrew scholar that is a scholar relative to the ancient text, the Dead Sea Scroll age text of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. I would be very surprised if there were such a beast. And if there are, there would be a handful of them. Now, the religious scholars are these very guys that have brought us the translations, like the Jewish Publication Society, the JPS, translation of the Tanakh, and prior to them, the New King James and the New American Standard. These are the same guys that managed to misrepresent the majority of the text. And so if you're going to go to them for a nuance of grammar, when it is known that they have collectively contributed to rubbish as it relates to the actual translation of the words and the representation of the words, now, that's kind of like going to the mafia and saying, you know, I want to have a moral code to live by that is true and correct, and I thought that you, as the head of the mafia, could provide me with one. I mean, goodness gracious, what are you thinking?
It's sort of like going to Satan and asking him, what do you think Yahweh's opinion is on this matter?
Yeah.
I mean, now, that's what it's like. Really.
In all fairness, what I have consistently said is that I have provided the reader with the Hebrew word so that you can look up the Hebrew word for yourself, and encourage everyone to do it, to learn for themselves what the words say. And then I wrote Intro to God, with the beginning of it saying, here's what the letters look like. Here's what the letters convey. Here's the Hebrew moods. Here's the Hebrew stems. Here's the Hebrew conjugations. This is what all of those things mean. This is the way that Hebrew is written. Here are the oldest texts. Now, we're going to use this to translate what Yahweh had to say, and I provided you with all the tools right up front so that you can do this right along with me. And then I go through and say, you know, there's lots of different ways to render this word, and if my choice is hugely inconsistent with today's translation, I'll write a paragraph on it, you know, or two paragraphs, and say, here's how they came up with what they did. Here's why I came up with what I did. You're free to disagree, but at least now you're equipped to understand what the options are. And I never say that mine are perfect. As a matter of fact, while I think Hebrew is as perfect a conduit to convey Yahweh's message as is possible in language, the moment we translate from Hebrew to English, we become markedly imperfect. There is no way whatsoever to convey completely, accurately, appropriately all of these very deep Hebrew thoughts into English. We almost have to have a discussion about it to get there. And when we go into the Aaronic blessing and begin to translate, you'll see you really have to have a discussion about it to convey all of the nuances that are there. But that very transition from one language to another always brings in a diminishment of the accuracy. Okay? So that's the...
Can I mention something here before you get started?
Sure.
You know, context is everything. I had done a post earlier this week about the fact that Yah was not omnipresent. Pointed it out. And so what does a guy do? He lays down a psalm from David where you are with me, you put me to bed, you get me up in the morning, blah, blah.
Yeah,
and I said,
that, by the way, is the Aaronic blessing, is that Yahweh pays attention to and he is with his children. He focuses on his children.
This was my point. That's what I pointed out. I said, if you want to equate people Yahweh does not know and says he does not know with Dode, you're out of your mind.
You're out of your mind.
This is the exact type of thing I would expect out of a religious individual. And I said, and beyond, then he said, well, we all know the word know could perhaps, as an example, mean sex. And I said, well, if you're irrational enough to believe God is saying, I didn't have sex with you people. I said, if you can't make that kind of a determination, you're an absolute moron. That's where I left it, and then I booted him off my page.
That's all you can do is go away. Yep.
Right,
okay.
But we do know this. We do know, and I just want to say this, we do know that Yahweh tears into the rabbis. He says it's your instructions have destroyed the covenant. You've destroyed it. And further, this passage we're talking about is in a whole group of passages that's doing what?
Destroying religion.
Religion.
Right.
And so I want to leave it there. And now all of a sudden, why would you bring up food? Oh, but by the way, keep my food laws. That's not what he said.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Louis Free today. The thing that caused him to say that he was orthodox was that he ate kosher. Kosher and eating kosher is the epitome of being an orthodox religious Jew. And so it is... when you read this in this context of his get rid of every religious artifact, icon, thought in the land, and in your presence, and then you have him destroy the heart and soul of rabbinic Judaism. In context, it makes a great deal of sense. It flows from beginning to end in context. And then it fits into Yosha's statement that a man is not defiled by what goes into his mouth, but what comes out of his mouth. And it is consistent with Yosha's statement, eat what is set before you. So when you, my friend today did, Louis Free, he said that he's a vegan because, and what he does is take one passage out of context. He takes the Genesis statement, the Bereshit statement, in the garden, all of the trees and that you have to eat from. It's all good. And he says, I'm a vegan. And I said, well, you probably should know, my friend, that Yahweh's testimony on what you should and should not eat, and it's always instructions on things which are good for you and things that are not good for you. And in the first one, all he listed was what was good for them because there was no death in the garden. Therefore, you couldn't eat meat because nothing was dying in the garden. So it didn't say anything against meat. It simply said that I have provided this for you and it's good for you. And then when they're sent out of the garden, he has them till the land, which means now it's breads and vegetables and something other than fruit. And then as we move and we're in the wilderness during the Exodus, He has a these things are good to eat and these things are not food discussion with him that expands the list of things and absolutely unequivocally includes among those things that are good to eat meat.
Meat.
And then he makes an exemption on what we can butcher and consume. And then he says, you know, a man is not defiled by what goes into his mouth, but what comes out of his mouth. So there is a progression, just as on this instruction, like any father would provide their son or daughter as they grow up. You know, when a child is two, you don't teach them about how to drive a car. You know, when they're three, you might teach them how to ride a tricycle, and when they're five, you may teach them how to ride a bike, but it's not until they're 15 that you're going to teach them how to drive a car. And so it's a different set of instructions applied to all of those things. All right, so the context there, I thought, was quite important, and if you don't take Devarim 15 in the context of all of Devarim 12, I think that you would be more likely to miss the intent. So it says here in every single these five unrelated Hebrew scholars, both religious and secular, every single one explained. By the way, you couldn't get five scholars to agree on much of anything. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. They naturally disagree. That Deut 12:15 could not be translated the way C.W. purports. Now, this is interesting. Could not. It's prefixed in the third person masculine singulars. Clean and unclean cannot be the subject because in Hebrew, subjects follow verbs, and clean and unclean precede the verb, the second application of eat. And to say that the third person singular masculine cannot be translated as the singular third person masculine and has to be translated as in the plural, has to be, and has to apply to a subject that is in the wrong order in Hebrew, preceding the verb rather than following the verb, is to say, you know, you're making a case that isn't credible. To say that, as James did, that there are some examples, some exceptions, where third-person masculine singular can apply to two individuals, and there are examples of exceptions. Now, that's valid. So that would be to say, quite different from what this person is writing, where could not be translated the way that I purport. The James's research came up with there are some exceptions where, for
it's
example,
not often, but there are a handful where you do.
There are a handful.
See that.
There are a handful of exceptions that where two people are referred to in the singular. Now, in the case that you gave me, it was Moshe was walking.
Moshe and Aaron, Aharon.
Yeah, and Aaron was walking with him. Now, there would be a reason to view them as one. All Aaron does is speak for Moshe. It was a deal that God cut for Moshe. And so it's...
Right, so they don't really have to do it.
We do see instances where Aharon oversteps those bounds.
Right, and when they became two distinct people and distinct functions, then Yahweh put Aaron back in his place and said, no. Moshe is my guy, not you. The intelligent way to deal with the fact that it's absolutely prefaced in the third person masculine singular is to say, rather than it cannot be rendered in the singular, is to say there are a few exceptions where the singular does refer to two people, although in those exceptions there's usually a reason that the two should be seen as one.
Because it's a one-purpose situation.
Correct.
That's what's happening there. I get that.
My issue there is
the wa in Hebrew. The wa doesn't just convey the and, it can also convey the with. So like
right.
in the example of Moshe and Aharon, it would literally be, and Moshe walked with Aharon, or Moshe
right.
with Aharon walked.
Right.
The
yes. And then,
Moshe,
the first
Aharon
person
is
singular is dealing with Moshe, not with Aharon, right? So my point here is that well, you know, I don't care if I do care, but I mean it's the issue isn't whether I made a mistake or not. The issue here with an email that says that it's impossible to unacceptable, totally impossible to render a first or a third person singular a masculine pronoun as singular. Now that's ridiculous.
Singular is singular, isn't it?
You know, you can say there are some exceptions, and you can argue that this may be one of those exceptions, and then you've made a valid point. But to say it cannot, that reminds me of those people who say that they absolutely know for certain that the day that Pesach is going to be celebrated, and they promote it as this is the day. And I would say, you know, this is the means that I use to evaluate it, and, you know, I think an argument can be made for the next day or the previous day. But, you know, here's the analysis, and I think that the moment you get to be dogmatic and you say can't ever under any circumstances, you've rendered yourself into a dogmatic corner, which is indefensible.
I was thinking about this whole thing with the food discussion. Yeah, I honestly have no problem if someone wants to make the comment that we should follow Yah's instructions pertaining to food. I do have a problem with you must. You know, should is right. Yes, we should. It would be in our best interest to follow it. It would be a much healthier diet than most of us eat today. But there's a big difference between should and must.
I'm not even sure that should is correct. He gave instructions on food. We can learn a lot from them. And I think in particular this exemption and Yosha's statements are extraordinarily revealing because we'll talk more about the reasons why we don't want to do anything that creates the impression that the Torah is a set of laws to obey.
If we refuse to eat something
because, let's say, you're going out with a group of friends, and this was my issue with it long, long ago, is if I went out with family, and once I learned that Torah meant teaching and guidance, and it wasn't laws to obey, but I was becoming Torah observant. And if I was out with my family or with friends and I said, no, I can't have baby back ribs. I can't have pizza with pepperoni. I can't do that. I won't do that. Because I'm Torah observant, then all I'm doing is, well, then are you kosher and have you converted to Judaism?
Yeah.
Are you, you know, Torah must mean a bunch of laws to obey. You certainly don't obey all of the Torah's laws. You know, why choose this one? And I knew that would
put you in a stupid position.
I knew that would be counterproductive. So I chose after a lot of thought to not treat the Torah's instructions as if they were laws to obey. I thought it would be counterproductive rather than productive. So I've never turned down
baby back ribs because, you know, using the, you know, I'm Torah observant excuse, but I have before because, one, they're more expensive. Two, you know, I'm trying to, you know, lose a little weight, so I won't. But
yeah.
Like I said, you know, it goes
those,
to that.
Those
you
are all valid. If you go to a restaurant
and you're
with your wife and you and your wife are both Torah observant and you're part of the covenant, in that case, you're not going to order the baby back ribs off the menu. I get that. But if you're out and you're in mixed company where somebody is not part of the covenant and you say, no, I won't have what everybody else is having, I won't touch that because I'm Torah observant. I think what you have done is counterproductive.
I think so, too. And by the way, you and Kurt went over Shamar quite a bit today, too. And that's what people really have to get. Exercise your brain. You know, that's what this is about.
Yeah, that's, you know, I want to, and I don't know if he's listening tonight, but I do want to go back over that before we move on through this letter. And by the way, Kirk did something that Kirk doesn't normally do. Kirk actually used an unused Facebook account to read this, and it sickened him. The whole thing sickened him. I've really come to enjoy Kirk. I just think the man has an uncommon ability to see things. He creates lists that provide a comprehensive overview of what we're learning. He has this visual nature where he goes right to the root of the yods and tittles, and he speaks so plainly that to review, for example, Yaokanan 3 with him has not only been a just wonderful, I mean, just an absolutely wonderful experience and really fun for me, but I think it's
hugely enlightening. Yeah, Kirk has a very different perspective than I do, and I love that.
I love it. God, I love that man. I really do. I just, I could not be pleased with someone's participation in these programs than I have been with what he has done on Yaokanan 3. It's just it's been marvelous. Okay, so
this might be the best week and a half of programs I've heard on there ever.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. It's the best week and a half we have ever been part of. I absolutely agree, and it's because of the material. So 12:15 could not be translated the way CW purports. By the way, they're not talking about the meaning of any of the words, not questioning the meaning of any words. We're only talking about the application of the third person singular masculine prefixed pronoun. The Hebrew grammar does not allow it, although trying to force English grammar into the verse might. Now, think about how ridiculous that is. What language are we translating the Hebrew into?
English.
Right. Does English, if I were to write or speak where my grammar was childish, was inappropriate, if I had subject-verb conflicts, if I was using the wrong pronoun, if my grammar sucked in English, would I make God sound like he's a moron?
I mean, yeah.
Isn't the whole exercise to communicate what is stated in Hebrew into English so that it is grammatically accurate in English?
Right. This sounds like the argument with the Muslims that you can't translate Arabic. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Yes, you can.
You know, the whole purpose of a translation is to render what is written in Hebrew into English, recognizing that English grammar is different. For example, this the Aaronic blessing. Yahweh is the subject. Always, all the way through this, Yahweh is the subject. He always follows the verb. His name always follows the verb. If even though the verbs are prefixed, he is doing this and he is doing that, the name follows. And so we wouldn't say he has decided to kneel down and bless you, Yahweh, and he has decided that that's not the way we write in English. In English, it is subject, verb, object. So, So as you said, it might be okay to render it the way I rendered it if I'm translating it into English. Yes. Yes, I
Isn't that what you're doing?
Yes, friends, I am trying to translate it into English. Yes, that is true. Okay. I was told this is a very common mistake made by amateur translators. You know,
thank
I am
God
amateur.
For amateur translators.
But,
that's
you know,
all I can tell you.
Okay,
here.
Let me. I am an amateur, and I'm happy to be an amateur. I've begun every one of the books I've written in the first paragraph. Right in the first paragraph, I say I'm irrelevant. I don't have any qualifications that would impress anybody. I mean, I don't know how I could make it more clear that I am an amateur. Now, while
well, you know, technically speaking, the only difference between an amateur and a professional is a professional gets paid for it.
Yeah, well, that's true. And
that
so,
is literally the only difference if you look up what amateur and professional means.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now, I'm going to speak a bit about being an amateur, and then I'm going to talk about why this yanked my chain. Yahweh doesn't work with professionals. He just doesn't. He doesn't work with paid anybody. If you want to work with Yahweh, you ain't getting paid for it, not in monetary terms. And if even if you're thinking about what the rewards are spiritually, your mindset is all screwed up. You don't do this because you expect Yahweh to give you some benefit later. You just don't do it. God doesn't work with professionals, not with academics, not with religious professionals, not with secular scholars. He doesn't choose PhDs. He doesn't pick the guy that has the best education. He doesn't pick the guy that's the most articulate. He doesn't pick the person who is the most popular. He doesn't work that way. So,
Dode and Mosey were both shepherds. Noah, he was a guy that grew grapes. He made, he had vineyards. All the disciples were fishermen.
Right.
You know, none of these guys were from the ivory tower scholars.
Abraham was a king in Babylon, right?
Yeah,
he was one of their high scholars or priests, right?
He was a great religious leader.
Sure he was.
Yahweh likes working with people who have no credentials because they are reliant on him. Now, I can tell you, folks, that as an amateur, without any qualifications whatsoever, by studying what Yahweh has to say and being receptive and reliant on him, I'm willing to bet that there are several hundred insights that we have talked about on these programs and in these books that you've never seen anyplace else.
Yes.
As an example, mitzvah is no longer command.
Right.
They're terms and conditions
of the covenant.
You know,
mitzvah
yeah,
is not a judgment. It's the means to exercise good judgment and to resolve disputes. And how did we come up with that? By being open. By looking at how Yahweh uses the word, by looking at the roots of the word, by examining everything you could consider, and then doing it that way and finding out that every time you do it that way, it works.
It works.
Always
yeah, it fits.
It works. It works. It fits.
Start
it's affirmed.
Start to finish.
And then you find it underscored and by Yahweh. But that's the realization, is that Yahweh does not work through scholars. For example, let's just pretend that there were five scholars. Do you think that any of them know Yahweh? Do you think any of them understand the Torah? Do you think any of them are members of the covenant?
No, I don't. If they're theologians, I know for 100% fact they're not.
I'm going to go one step further. I don't think it's possible to convey what Yahweh was communicating to us accurately, unless you know it. This is not just an exercise in like a scientific, academic exercise of words. It is you're sharing the testimony of a very unique individual, and that testimony has to always be consistent with his nature, with his approach, with his attitude, with his plan, with who he is, And if you do not know him, I don't think there's any way to do it. I think that's why there's so many inaccuracies in Bible publications.
Yeah, that one of the famous ones, just for the hell of it, I'll throw it out there, the Psalm. The beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord.
Yes.
Tripe.
Now,
trash.
Here's the next part of it. Yeah, it says here that although, let's see, I was a very common mistake made by amateur translators who are not fluent in Hebrew and are all, and it always leads to confusion and incorrect understanding. Actually, it can be dangerous. All right, so let's go through each of these things. Amateur was used here to be demeaning. And not
sure.
Demeaning to me personally, although it was demeaning to me personally, but demeaning to the translations. I don't care what you say about me. I mean, you could Google my name and you'll probably read 100,000 negative things about me. I don't care. Never bothers me. The only thing that bothers me is somebody who is an insider who therefore can be more effective at demeaning the translations where we are attempting to convey as accurately as we're able what God is communicating to us. And
you mean actively working to destroy credibility? Yeah,
right.
I've got a problem with that.
And the credibility as it relates to conveying what God said. And
right.
on that, yeah, I really do bow my back. On that, that is the last time somebody did that as an insider, I took a year off. I don't know if you all remember, but it was a guy that claimed to be smarter at Greek translations than any Greek scholar.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he wrote a book criticizing, questioning Paul, and he missed the entire point.
I've seen his translations, by the way. He tried to amplify like you do. He followed your amplification technique,
So
he wasn't even original. Then what he would do, he'd take a word, and there would be like 700 meanings behind it. I mean, every word has a paragraph. It's the most insane trash I've ever read.
Oh,
it's trash.
You can't understand a word of it. And then you get to the bottom line is that in questioning Paul and focusing on Galatians, first of all, it's ludicrous to contend that Paul didn't write it but did write Romans. I mean, it's absolutely a ludicrous position. But even if you aren't convinced that Paul wrote Galatians, why does it matter? Why does it matter? The fact is that Galatians and the message that it conveys all the way through the Pauline letters is wholly inconsistent with Yahweh and his Torah and with Yahusha. So it is wrong, and so the basis of Christianity is wrong, regardless of who wrote it. And the nuanced differences between the verbal tenses was absolutely irrelevant in the purpose of the book. And so this person just was pedantic and self-serving and argumentative for the express purpose of trying to satisfy some need for personal recognition. And I thought it was so irritating that the credibility was being destroyed this way. I said, you know, either he's going to step down or I'm going to step down. So I just stepped down. And I don't have a problem stepping away. I wish there were others that would step up and fill the gap. But, when you're dealing with the credibility of this of the translations in this negative a way by comparing them to what religious and secular scholars say on something as pedantic as the application of a prefixed pronoun. Good grief.
Look, I've read the book named after the sun goddess, Biblia.
Yeah.
And I've seen actual Paleo-Hebrew amplifications next to what they claim it's saying. They are uniformly wrong. Some of the verses that we find in the Biblia created by the biblical experts are so bad, they don't make sense in any language at all.
Now, this says, by those who are not fluent in Hebrew. The moment you this individual wrote that, they gave themselves away.
In Paleo Hebrew,
fluent in Hebrew means that they speak modern Hebrew.
Yeah,
now,
which is nothing.
The language has been so manipulated over time, particularly not only out of the Babylonian experience, but when Hebrew was not spoken in 1948. And so when all of the Yehudim and Yisraelites came into Yisrael, they all spoke the language of whatever country they came from. And no one was speaking Hebrew, so they needed to come up with a common language, and they came up with a modern adaptation of Hebrew to speak. And, you know, there's many similarities between the ancient language and the modern language, but the modern language was a derivative of the Masoretic vowel pointing in about the 11th century. And to be fluent in modern Hebrew is not helpful in translation. I have specifically avoided doing that. You know, I have my my Rosetta Stone modern Hebrew, and I've just consistently felt the wrong way to go. The right way to go is what, if we don't have time tonight, we'll do it next week, where we'll translate a passage on the fly together. Because when you have to look at each of the words and consider their meaning as they are presented in a variety of lexicons and really think about it, as opposed to just read it and you know, just go to a singular concept, you're going to be at the very least incomplete and probably inaccurate. For example, in modern Hebrew, they are so convinced that that their oral law is a form of Torah, and that to shamar means to keep it in the sense of obey, that if they're fluent in Hebrew, that's what they're going to read. That is what
they're going to read, obey. That's exactly right. Look,
that's
you know, my wife got a degree in movie directory.
Uh-huh.
You know, she's actually a movie director. And I'll tell you, she told me, and trust me when I tell you this, college in Iran is way tougher than college here. No matter what you think, they're not even in the same league. She told me the worst course she had was translating two paragraphs of ancient Persian, which is not as old as Paleo Hebrew.
Right.
Ancient Persian into modern Persian. She told me she couldn't tell you. She couldn't ask how to cross the street or where the store is in ancient Persian. She couldn't do it. She said it would be impossible.
You know,
and
Arabic, which is a language that was actually came to a written form in the 7th century. The difference between the Arabic and the 7th century is different from modern standard Arabic, is more different, more variant than Latin is from Italian. And it's just enormously different. So to be fluent in modern Hebrew is a liability in trying to translate the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, because you're applying the evolution of the language to a text that it's now shading in a very religious way. And so that gives the whole thing away. Now, this next line is what was just so irritating to say, that it leads to confusion and inaccurate understanding. It can be dangerous. So since all of the introduction to God, questioning Paul, and yada yada, provide amateur translations, then the direct consequence of that is that the introduction to God, yada yada, and questioning Paul would therefore be confusing, inaccurate, and dangerous. Now, all of this, by the way, from what is perceived to be an inaccurate application of the third person masculine singular prefixed pronoun. Now, yeah, I want to tell you, That's revolting. That's demeaning. It's disgusting. It's untrue. It's inappropriate. I want to know why I was angry. That's why I was angry. I was just, it's just so inappropriate to go all the way to that point. And it, come on. Just don't do that. Sometimes you just, I don't know how many times I've written letters that I'm glad I didn't send, and I waited the next day and I softened them, and I waited the next day and I softened it some more. Somewhere along the way, you ought not say amateur translations by those who are not fluent in Hebrew always lead to confusion and incorrect understanding. Always lead to confusion. That means always. It means everything that we collectively have all benefited from.
Yeah, that means on Kippurim, which is Chag, which is a celebration, we'll all be fasting because it means afflictions.
Yeah.
It doesn't really mean reconciliations, so, even though we see the point where the family is reconciled on that day in the fulfillment of Kippurim. When they're reconciled, they will starve together.
Yeah,
he even makes a point, and food will be eaten in Jerusalem that day, period.
Yeah. Now, this goes on to make a brings JB into it, but you have to listen to the words the way they're written here. JB admits that he's not good at Hebrew grammar either. So that means that both JB, you and I are not good at
it. Couple of boobs. Yeah.
I'm not going to claim that I'm good.
No problem.
I've never claimed that I'm good. All I've ever claimed is that I have done my best to render what I am reading as accurately and completely as possible, and I say that I go into every statement with two thoughts in mind. One is never translate anything out of context. You'll never find me going into a single verse. Never translate it out of context, because the context is going to lead to understanding. And number two, never say anything that's inconsistent with Yahweh's nature. Period. That's just it. And so that's my proclivity. And if a word has eight different meanings and seven are inconsistent with Yahweh's nature and plan, I'll pick the eight. You know?
You mean you think about what you're writing. You consider
the
subject.
I consider
this would be
a
good idea.
Yeah, I rather like the subject.
I like him.
I like the way he communicates. I like his style. I like his attitude. I like his thoughts. I like everything about him. And the more I study, the more I like him. And so what I find myself trying to do is to translate from his perspective as he has revealed himself through his testimony. And so making an exemption appeals to me.
In Zechariah, you've got a translation here. I just want to read it real quickly. This is Zechariah 14:16. This is taking place at the end of the Battle of Armageddon. Okay? The whole existing remnant from all the Gentile nations who came to attack Jerusalem in accord with the multitude of Allah, with repeated and repetitious prostrations in accord with their king, will celebrate Yahweh's festival feast of Sukkah. So there appears to be a group that, you know, they're forced to come and attack Jerusalem,
right,
and they end up siding with their Yehudi brethren. Now, you go to any other religious text, and
right,
I'll tell you what you're going to see. You're going to see people will come up to celebrate Sukkah every year with Yahweh, and they will bow to him.
Right.
Now, I'm going to tell you why I know your translation's accurate. Yahweh will not be bowed to. He can't stand it. He's consistent throughout all his words. He didn't lose his mind there and say, now I'm going to become like Chairman Mao.
Right.
And that's who you've got in your standard
translation.
He didn't
write his name with two people kneeling down. He doesn't even have a variation of any letter with somebody bowed down.
No, he doesn't.
Time he uses Barak to kneel down in relation to man, he's the one that's kneeling.
That's correct. We had that today, too, I think.
Spoken of in the Shamar conversation.
Yeah, it's
just goes
always
on
the
and
one
on,
doing, he's always the one doing the kneeling, and it makes sense. That's why I like Yao. It makes sense. He's bigger than we are. Since
yeah,
he's
so
bigger than we are,
bowing,
it makes sense if we're going to relate that he kneeled down to lift us up. Since he's bigger than we are, why in the what's the purpose of me kneeling down trying to lift him up? I mean,
yeah, I used to walk into my house to my kids and say, bow to me and present money.
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right, this goes on to say, if one is proposing a translation that is diametrically opposed to every Hebrew scholar out there, don't you think it would be a good idea to run it past an expert before, capital before, putting it out there? When you say something like diametrically opposed to every Hebrew scholar, you're revealing yourself as someone who is not able to think in context. You're not able to understand the wide variation that there are in every art form, and translation happens to be an art form, and to render a prefixed preposition consistent with the way that it is written, if that is diametrically opposed to every Hebrew scholar, we really have a problem, don't we? And if that's what you're going to hang your hat on, is diametrically opposed to every, not just five, every Hebrew scholar, I think you've got a problem. I mean, I think the person who wrote the letter needs to look in the mirror. Now, this person, I understand today, from what Scott told me, who went on the Facebook site, claimed that I was slandering them. Now, I'm reading what you wrote. I don't even know your name. I don't care what your name is. I'm reading what you wrote. If reading what you wrote slanders you, then maybe you ought not have written it. I want to tell you, there are a lot of approaches to saying, I disagree. This is not a good one. You embarrassed yourself.
Well, I think most of the people in Unpopular Truth happen to disagree with her. I most of us are thankful. I know I am. I wouldn't know what I know today had I not come across yadaya.com, you know, years ago. I know what I know because of it. And, you know, I'm thankful that you're out there working hard and revealing Yahweh's words. He had people that did that in the past. It's a good thing you're doing it today.
So long as you recognize what I constantly say, which is that don't rely on me. Rely on what Yahweh said.
Yeah, that's
verify
another thing.
Verify it.
Nobody who's ever done this type of endeavor has turned around and said, look, I was wrong.
Yeah,
I'm
so this person
it.
Continues to attack me, especially if you, now speaking to me, writing me directly now, especially if you have followers.
Followers.
Do I have any followers? How many times do I
have friends?
I have brothers and sisters. I have friends.
Yeah.
I have brothers.
Yeah,
I have friends. I have enemies. I have no followers.
General Wynn. General
Wynn. I have never presented myself as an example. To write such drivel pisses me off, by the way. I mean, it's one thing. You're talking about thousands of hours for free of taking the risk of translating, knowing for certain that it was impossible for me to be as accurate as possible with these words without saying something that proved to be inaccurate. It's just not feasible to take on an undertaking so radically different than the translations that you see in published material and not become insanely vulnerable because I've got 7,000 pages out there. Now,
people attacking your translations, I've seen them since they've attacked you, use your translations.
Yeah. Well,
what do
you know,
think
and my appeal is, if you don't like these translations, if you think they're wrong, go do your own.
Right.
Go do your own and share them. You know, I've got no issue with that. I'm not claiming my translations.
Even if you don't think they're wrong, go do your own.
That's
even
right.
Even
if
you
don't
go do it yourself.
Yeah, but don't pretend that I have followers. don't pretend that people trust and that I know what I'm doing.
For nearly a decade, I've been emailing with you on a fairly regular basis, usually at least once a week or so for the last 5 to 6 years.
Right.
And, you know, I come to areas where I disagree with you.
Yes.
So, yeah, I really don't like, I don't consider myself a follower of anybody. Yeah, no offense. I love you. You're my brother.
Yeah.
You're my friend, but
yeah.
I don't consider myself a follower of yours.
No, you know, in fact, a lot of times you'll take the adversarial position just to see if it can be proven, right? Which I think is a wise thing to do. To say, okay, well,
yeah, that was really when we really first became friends was when you were writing Questioning Paul, and you asked for people to help you edit it, and
yes.
I was one of the people that volunteered. And mainly, what I did was I was on the fence at that point, and so every time I came across them, I'm like, well, what about this? Well, what about this?
Yeah, you were constantly devil's advocate. Yeah.
Well, not even at the time. It was really just the questions I had, which is why by the time Questioning Paul was done, I had no questions concerning Paul. Everything, every possible thing I could come up with, you had addressed in the book. And so, you know, at that point, it was really like, okay. But, you know, that was what I did. That was, you know, every question I had. I wasn't sure you were right. You know, when you first started, you know, talking about Paul being wrong, comparing Paul to Muhammad, I was like, oh, I don't know about this. He made me off on this. And so I started looking at, well, what about this? What about that? So I'm like, well, I'll ask him. And you know, you came up with it. Okay, that answer makes sense.
Yeah. Well, don't take my word. This ends then. Don't take my word on it. Do your own research. This person, by the way, didn't do their research. They didn't translate on their own. They didn't dig into the text on their own. They went to an expert. They went to what they thought was a scholar. So this is not a person doing research in terms of examining the text themselves and trying to come up with a translation that's consistent with what Yosha said, and Yahweh's evolving testimony regarding diet. This is the person that went to the scholars. Now,
well, first of all, she's wrong about that. You say there's exceptions. Okay, there is a few exceptions, but not many. Most of the time, it's going to read just the way you put it.
Well, for a number of reasons. One is that the clean and unclean come before the verb. And subjects in Hebrew, while they can and do on occasion, the vast majority of the time, the subject follows the verb. And the vast, overwhelming percentage of the time, if the text has singular, it means singular.
So this is a very unusual sentence in Hebrew. Yeah, the typical Hebrew sentence is structured verb, subject, object. So, like, literally, ate James pizza.
Right.
But what we're
and the modifier
here is
follows the
verb
the,
middle,
the modifier follows the verb and
the
modifier follows the noun. It's a and you can't write it that way in English without it being stilted and making the author, in this case Yahweh, look like he is a poor communicator. So it's important to do this. But in the case where the Hebrew positions something where the modifiers follow the nouns, and so clean and unclean is modifying something before it. It's not the subject of a sentence because it precedes that final verb. The modifier. It's speaking of the flesh again. And it's not the, you know, we're going to, JB, and I think this is, the whole concept of translation is interesting. So, you know, in a, by the way, this ends by saying, don't take my word on it, do your own research. I did, and I will never trust Craig Wynn's translations again. Okay, don't. Go away.
I posted in the chat room earlier. You know, I have checked a lot, and I mean a lot of your translations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I lost count of how many, hundreds of hundreds. And while there are areas where, like, I would translate it differently or I, you know, see things slightly differently, I have never once come across one of your translations where I'm like, well, there's no way to get that. Every one of them, I can see how you came to what you came to. I mean,
right.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, well, there's this alternative, and this makes a little more sense
yeah.
to me. But I've
yeah.
never come across anything where I'm like, no, this is just outright wrong. There's no way he can get. And like
yeah.
I said, I haven't checked all
yeah.
of them. It's not
yeah,
all
and most of the,
yet,
and most of the time that my rendering is divergent, significantly divergent from that which is most common, I'll write paragraphs explaining the process that I went through to come to that, so that you know the justification for it and can determine whether or not you think the reasoning and evidence is sound. I'm not trying to sell it. I'm just trying to understand it and to share with the understanding.
Yada's yeah. translations are a starting point. And
yeah.
That's a good way to look at it. It's a good
right.
way to start. Yeah, that was how I started learning how to translate was, all right, here's his translation. Here's the common English one. All
right,
right, let's load up Logos and let's see how he got what he got.
The whole purpose of writing Intro to God was to make my translations irrelevant. You know, and the purpose of Yada Yah was to introduce people to Yahweh through his most profound prophecy so people could come to know him as he introduced himself to us. But then in Intro to God, I decided, why not begin it by giving people all of the tools and an explanation of what all these tools mean and how to deploy them, and then after you've given them the full toolbox so they can translate on their own, every resource, the whole process and that you go through, after explaining all of that over 100 pages, then to go through another 1,000 or 2,000 pages of examples using that process. So you explain, here's the owner's manual on all the parts of the bicycle, and here's how all the parts go together, and this is how to maintain and use the bicycle. Now let's go ride it. And let's go ride it for days and days and days and practice riding it using what we've learned. That's Intro to God. It's designed so that you don't have to rely on my translation. You can go up and do your own. And that's a good thing to do. All right. Now, we only have 7 more minutes left today. But let's...
Actually, I extended the show length to 2 hours since we seem to routinely go over the hour and a half. That way, people don't have to wait for archives.
Okay.
But we
well,
can
then,
end it at any point. So.
Then let me read what you wrote on Devarim 12, and we'll talk about the migration here. Okay, so you wrote, since it seems like it might come up on the Sabbath, I thought I would share my view. So studying Devarim 12, I've come to a different conclusion than you. Much like our difference on the timing of Pesach, I don't see this as I'm right and you're wrong. While I thought your translation made a great confirmation of how I already viewed Yah's Torah instructions regarding food, after looking at the text, and the context, I see an alternative that seems clear. I may be wrong, and I thought I would share it with you to see if I am missing something. And what I shared with you is that the thing I think you're missing is Yosha's statements, which kind of tilted. That's the decider for me. Now, that being the case, I still don't think you've said anything that's wrong. I think your position could easily be accurate. I just don't think it's the only position. I think that's kind of where both of us are here. This is definitely an exemption that is being spoken of. And that's, by the way, the thing that turned me off initially when this came up, Larry, in the chat room. The first 2 or 3 people who wrote after our program on Devarim 12 began their saying that kind of angrily that God doesn't contradict himself, and I can't believe that God would contradict his food instructions. And that's the kind of approach that is just flat-out wrong here. This is an exemption.
He didn't contradict anything. He didn't contradict anything. He added to
no.
So
this
it's out
is
of the same Torah.
And
right.
there's
this
no
is
way
an exemption.
Like this that wouldn't make it an exemption. There
right.
is absolutely
yeah.
no
it's,
way
it's whether it is an exemption
no
to hygiene, whether it's an exemption to offerings, or it's an exemption to food that is consumed, well, it's one of those three things, and it is an exemption. But an exemption is not a contradiction. And so for those of you who yeah. said, I can't believe that God would contradict himself and be miffed at what we shared on these prior programs as if it were a contradiction, understand that an exemption is not a contradiction. And understand, too, that it relates to food that can be consumed. Yah's instructions evolve from eat fruit to toil in the ground, and which means you're going to produce grains and vegetables, to eat these meats are good, these meats are not food for you, to this exemption, to Yosha's eat whatever's put in front of you. There's an evolution in his instructions based upon the time, and the time isn't just strictly on when, for example, pork and shellfish like shrimp may have become safe, but you have to understand that with Yosha and the timing of his eat whatever is put in front of you, dealing with the perfect application of the verb eat under a thoughtful basis, that the risk of his disciples being seen as being religious Jews obeying Torah as if it were law on what they would and wouldn't eat was a much greater risk than was the chance that they were going to get sick and die because they ate a shellfish or some pork. And so there were risks either way, and I'm personally convinced that Yosha saw that the risk of the Torah being misunderstood and the message being misunderstood was far greater to the eternal health of those who would experience the witness of the disciples, that he valued that far more than he valued the concern over getting trichinosis from pork. So that's my take on the timing of it and why he approached it that way. Okay, so you said there is definitely an exemption being spoken of here. But I think that the exemption is to the instruction in Kara 17, which we'll go over in a minute, and that anything that was slaughtered was to be brought to the door of the tabernacle and that the loy was to sprinkle its blood on the altar. Evidencing this, this is scripturally and historically we see this happen, especially in as Yisrael grew and spread out, this would become impossible. But in the wilderness, it was possible, and it served a purpose. So it would seem to me that this is how those who heard this understood it and applied it. Now, the issue that I would have with that, JB, is that while I agree that that could be an interpretation of it, it clearly says, when the passage you talk about is about butchering the animal and bringing it to the temple. It doesn't talk about then consuming it. This begins. There's two applications of eat here, and the eating is what is being stressed. Not an offering. It's about eating, because eating is mentioned twice. Offering is not mentioned in this particular text.
About that, but that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's what. I'm not negating in any way your conclusion. I'm just adding something more to think about here.
That's part of the reason I send stuff like that to you is I have a thought. It's like, okay, this makes sense. Da da da.
Yeah.
All right. And, is there anything I'm missing? Let's get a fresh set of eyes on this.
Yeah. Yeah. And clearly,
sometimes you'll catch things like that that I don't see.
I really want to doubly emphasize that I loved your insights. I don't think your insights are wrong. I think that a stronger case can be made for the exemption being on unclean meat than an unclean offering, and I think an unclean offering is a far bigger exemption and more inconsistent with Yahweh's nature. It would actually be inconsistent with Yahweh's nature on the offering. You know, for a sacrificial offering, something that is unclean. But it's still a legitimate possibility, and it.
But that's exactly right. Either way, we have a problem here, don't we? If
an exemption is a contradiction, we have a problem.
Yeah.
And if clean and unclean is determined by what you eat or what you bring to the sacrifice, then we have a real problem. And fortunately, the Torah was written to remedy problems. You know, it's the Torah is written to liberate us, to free us from problems, not to bestow problems on us. Right. The Christian Pauline perspective on the Torah is it's a burden that lays problems that we cannot adhere to upon us. And Yahweh's perspective on the Torah is that it's guidance that frees us from all of these problems.
That's the first thing Christians will say. You know that.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're going to go out there and perform 618 or whatever they think laws.
Yeah, 613.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah,
and I tell them, you know, I do no such thing.
Okay.
You know,
now it goes on to say, so it would seem to me that this is how those who heard it understood and applied it. While the food laws would become an important and huge part of Jewish culture and a tradition at this time, there was no kosher eating laws deployed. And if they had understood this to mean that unclean animals could be eaten, then surely would have seen them eating unclean animals shortly thereafter. The Torah is clear that there was no big, that they were not big on following restrictions. So meat, it seems like a more likely intention. You know, and the issue here is that this does say eats twice in the Devarim passage. So there's twice. So they're definitely eating, and whether it's and so since it's emphasizing eating and not offering, you know, I think the plain reading of the words is fairly clear. Okay. I think there's validity to clean and unclean referencing people, not food. Now, this is where the argument, JB, that you make that I've already shared. I know that you pointed out that the verb was singular. It's not that the verb is singular. It's that the pronouns, both prefixed and suffixed pronouns, are singular. So that the pronouns that are attached are singular, not plural. Therefore, could not apply to the nouns clean and unclean. But that's not always the case. And you gave, for example, and this is the way that you phrased it, and the way you phrased it is totally accurate and appropriate. For it's not always the case. For example, in Shemot 4:29, we read that Moshe and Aaron walked. Halak is third person singular, but clearly applies to both Moshe and Aaron. And we've gone through the reasoning for that. It was Moshe walking with Aaron, and so it would be the verb is addressing Moshe walking. That's why the prefix was third person singular. And it's an exception. It's not the rule. So I see this as possible.
It's a very rare
exception. Yeah, it's a fairly rare exception.
I think I've found maybe four or five in all of what I've looked through that have that. It's a very uncommon thing.
Was it really that rare, though?
And it does exist in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Four or five
out of the thousands of applications. Yeah, thousands. In Hebrew, which can so you say the wa in Hebrew can convey with as well as and. So literally, Moshe walked with Aaron. So you came to the right conclusion here. So the same could be true in the Devarim of clean and unclean can eat, but they're not walking. They're clean and unclean are very distinct from Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron are an entirely different case. We've been through that. And he says, my problem is and I don't know if you capitalized for a reason of emphasis, but
now,
my problem.
That's a common problem I have in terms of typing, in that my fingers do not get off the
Yeah, I figured that you weren't shouting and you were not trying to emphasize yourself. I just figured that was
whenever I have two-letter words, I tend to do that. It's,
yeah,
I'm the king of typos,
so I was reading right through it. My problem with this understanding, however, is that we see the subject coming before the verb, when in Hebrew you typically see the subject after the verb. I mean, it's very rare in Hebrew to have the subject precede the verb. My other problem with this, and the last things that are mentioned in a sentence in Hebrew almost always modify either the verb or the noun. They're adverbs or adjectives most of the time. They're somehow modifying that which comes before, like wagon red rather than red wagon, ran fast rather than a fast runner. You know, it's that kind of thing in Hebrew. That's the order of things. But, you know, I don't want to be dogmatic here. I mean, there are exceptions.
Hello?
So we have to deal with the fact there are exceptions. So we'll continue here. So while where was I here in the text? Okay. So my other problem is with the change from second person you in most of the rest of Devarim 12. Yeah, Yahweh speaking to a wide group of people, and
yeah,
then
the you here
then
is
he,
Yisrael.
Yeah, and the you is Yisrael, and all of a sudden we have the third person singular. And, he didn't make the change. You know, not talking about you as clean or unclean. It's an it here. And so God doesn't make mistakes here. So you're noticing the same thing I am, that there was a deliberate change to third person masculine singular.
Yeah, literally every verse up until this, it's you. Then
right.
Here you get a they, and then it goes right
back
to
you. It's a problem here. So I am not 100% convinced in this, and I'm learning in this way. My view on the food, and by the way, I think the show that we did, reviewing Devarim 12 the second time after the criticism began, I just went through every word and I said, I'm going to lay it all out for you and say, here's the full range of meanings, and, choose whichever you want, and understand the options that are available to you. And the purpose of that was that we'd all learn together. So he says, my view on the food instructions is the same as it is on all of Yah's instructions. There is a spiritual aspect and a physical aspect. The physical aspect affects us physically, and the spiritual aspects affect us
that should be spiritually. I was
spiritually,
really fast.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If
I eat what Yah said not to, I will have physical consequences, but my relationship with him is not affected one bit. However, if I swallow religious muck, then my relationship with Yah is affected. So while Devarim 12 saying that it is okay to eat, it would reinforce this, I don't need to have it reinforced, since all of Yah's word reinforces it for me. Looking at your translation, I understand how and why you came to it, and I have not come across anything that makes me think or say that it is wrong. But this understanding right now is more convincing to me. Let me know what you think I'm missing. And I'm going to be honest, my response was short, only because I wanted to respond to you, JB, but I didn't have lots of time. I'm working 17-hour days here trying to prepare for a move while doing the show, and I'm sure you did not see it as being dismissive. I read it. I thoughtfully considered everything you said. And then I said, so why do you think that he was only addressing the Lowy and not all Yisrael on such a minuscule, which is, this is a fairly, you know, that passage on how to bring your first kill of the season to the Lowy? It's a fairly minuscule versus important issue. And if so, how do you explain Yahusha's statement, which is always the tiebreaker for me? And so you wrote, I don't think it was only addressing the Loi. The instruction in Kara 17 was to all Yisrael, pardon the English translation, and this is what it says. Any man from the house of Yisrael who slaughters a bull or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or who slaughters it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the door of the tent of meeting to bring an offering before the dwelling place, blood guilt is reckoned to that man. So this about bringing an offering on slaughtering a lamb or a goat in the camp.
Three specific animals.
Okay, two specific animals. And those two specific animals, about the first one that you, or any bull or lamb that you, or goat, three animals actually, in the camp that you slaughter, you have to bring it to the tent of the tabernacle for an offering. Okay, now none of us, of course, do that. Blood guilt is reckoned on that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. In order that the children of Israel bring their slaughterings, which they slaughter in the open field, and they shall bring them to Yahweh at the door of the tent of the meeting, to the priest, and slaughter them as peace offerings to Yahweh. And the priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of Yahweh at the door of the tent of the meeting, and shall burn the fat for a sweet fragrance to Yahweh. So you thought it was addressing the offering of animals that were slaughtered, that were be brought as a sacrifice. While there is that possibility, I don't think there would be such an emphasis on eating if that were the primary meaning. Okay, this would also explain
the
two
king animals. I didn't consider the emphasis on eating until you brought it up. That is interesting.
Yeah. This would also explain the use of two clean animals in Devarim 12. The deer and the gazelle were not on the list. And by the way, to get the deer and gazelle out of
they are a bit of a stretch from the actual meaning of the words.
A bit. A bit. We're talking about from here to from here to Tehran and back. Yeah, it's you know, as stretches go, that was one of the great stretches of all time to deer and I don't think deer and gazelle would even be there if it wasn't for trying to justify in its existing translations and in most of the places it's buck and stag are the most common English translations, a buck and a stag. I'm not sure there is a difference between the two, but they were really pushing for it. To be that were instructed.
Sides, if you're a hunter, at least.
Yeah.
A buck is bigger than a stag.
Yeah, well, that's
really the only difference, as far as I understand.
Yeah. So in the Devarim 12, anything you wish to eat, you may slaughter and eat just as you would the gazelle or deer. This lines up with all the clean and unclean eating. So the exemption is to animals that are no longer to be brought as peace offerings every time they were slaughtered and therefore can be eaten by anyone, clean or unclean. You know, I think that it's a bigger deal with Yahweh, what we present to him as a reconciling offering, than it is what we personally eat, because what we bring to him has spiritual implications, and what we personally eat only has physical implications. So this would be a much, much, much bigger exemption. And I don't know why he would say it would be okay to bring, for example, a pig to be a spiritual reconciling offering.
Hello, Yada?
Yes.
How you doing? It's William.
Hi, William.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
When you get a moment.
Okay. We want to finish James's letter. This would also explain the use of... Okay, we've gone through that. As for Yosha's statements based upon a combination of my lack of understanding of the Greek and my lack of knowledge of the Greek text, and to the degree which the Greek text has been edited, I have taken to the habit of not trying to let anything in the Greek text influence my understanding, so I have not taken Yosha's comments in Mark and Luke into account. And I can understand why you would be there, JB, but I've spent a lot of time on shattering myths today on this, and again this evening. I think we learn a lot based upon what's recorded at Yosha saying. We have to be cognizant that it's possible that some of it was added and copy-edited, but, you know, I don't think there was anyone of the four, Matanya, Luke, Mark, and Yao Kanan, who tried to misrepresent what they had heard. And, you know, just like we learned so much from Yao Kanan 3, that is so Torah consistent, it is, rather than just dismissing what you read, and I will dismiss everything, and even in Matanya, that isn't in Yosha's own words. If it's not Yosha saying it or doing it, I'm going to dismiss it, even if it's in Matanya. But if it's Yosha's words, I'm going to, my first preference, rather than to dismiss it, is to see if it is consistent, is to demonstrate that it is consistent with the Torah. So my preference is to do what we have done here, which is to show that Yosha's statements, rather than annulling the Torah, contradicting the Torah, are actually consistent with the Torah. That's a better approach than just disregarding them. So we're going to disagree.
My only difference in that would be that, you know, I think that Yosha, you know, reading Yosha's words can add a lot. Like, you've proven that with, you know, Yao Kanan 3, but...
Or with Matanya 5, 6, and 7.
Yosha didn't add anything.
I don't think he did.
You know, when Yosha confirms Yahweh's word, it's one thing, but I don't like to try... I try not to let it influence me, only in that, one, we, you know, one, we know he didn't add anything, and two, it's... how do I put this? You know, we can look at what he did, what he said, and how it, you know, correlates to the Torah. But we do know that stuff was added that contradicts the Torah,
right.
i.e., the, you know, let you without sin part.
Yeah, Kanan 8.
And for me, I don't like to look to try to let it influence me too much, and because of that, and
I have a slightly different perspective on it, and my perspective is that that. He is the diminished manifestation of Yah, and I understand the translation from Hebrew to Greek is difficult, and then from Greek to English, and the maintenance of the testimony by religious buffoons, and I know all of that. But I can tell you that you know, the only proclivity that I have that is beyond just a passion for who Yah is and what he had to say is I have a unique ability, I think, to understand things by making connections. And the thing that I've come to love about everything Yahweh has to say is it all connects, it all paints the same picture, it's all consistent. And I will tell you that many of the connections that I've come that have produced insights that we're sharing, like the three destinations, I didn't get that from the Torah. I got that from what Yosha said about casting a net and three different kinds of fish. That's where I got it. I didn't come to the idea that Yosha's body was consumed that night, even though that's what the Torah said. It didn't sink in until I was reading. Why does all four of these post-Bukurim accounts have him unrecognizable? And so much of, at least for me, my understanding of the Torah has come from what Yosha said that helped me understand it.
I think this is one area where our backgrounds make us a bit different in terms of, you know, you came from the Christian background of having studied a lot of, you know, the Bible, you know, to make it hard. Well, I haven't studied it a lot, so all of my first introduction to most things are coming from the Torah. So, like, my, you know, understanding of Yosha's body being destroyed came from reading about you know, Exodus, where it talks about destroying the Passover lamb.
Yeah.
So I came from it from a very different perspective from that because, I didn't have that background. And, so for me, a lot of it has been like, you know, the Psalm 19, you know, the Torah is complete, lacking nothing and all that. So,
yeah.
You know, that's why I'm leery of, you know, trying to use anything beyond the Torah to understand,
understand
the Torah.
Yeah, we're on the same page here, just a slightly different
perspective.
Yeah, and you know, I had already thought
very different areas.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought I was at the far extreme of diminishing the importance of Yahusha, because he is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, and instead focusing on Yahweh. I mean, I'm probably at the far extreme of doing that. You might even be more extreme than I am in this regard. But I'm here to tell you that I think I'm not nearly smart enough to have figured much of this out without having the benefit of the insight and perspective that Yahusha provided to us.
I would never be where I am if it weren't for the insight you provided to me. So,
that's how I came to understand this stuff. Yeah, I applied what I learned from Yahusha to the Torah, as this is the living manifestation of how you observe the Torah and what it means, and then I could see all of this spoken of and affirmed in the Torah. So I can see how Dode now came to the complete understanding without the benefit of Yahusha. I can see how he has done that, but it's only because I came there a different way. I came there the cheater way. I don't claim to be as smart as Dode.
Yeah.
All right. So
and
it
I
says,
doubly cheated because I cheated off you.
Well, then that's okay. That's okay. So this is what follows. It says that I've said, I'm glad that you shared this. I'm especially glad that you affirmed the recognition that in Hebrew subjects follow verbs. That is a killer for the opposition view. It is as it was with Passover, neither you nor I found fault with the other's translations or interpretations. But in the scope of all revelation, I have just come to slightly different conclusions, and that means that your interpretation is plausible as is mine. And as is the case with Passover, I've chosen an interpretation that is the most consistent with Yahusha's. I enjoyed reviewing your insights as always. Then you wrote, I was thinking about this some more, and perhaps there is a reason for the odd, somewhat ambiguous sentence structure. Hebrew typically follows the verb subject object structure, ate Craig pizza. So to definitely state one way or the other in the sentence in Devarim 12, it would have to read, eat clean and unclean it. But what you see is clean or unclean, eat it, which has the verb in the middle, either way you view it. Everything in Yah's Torah was written such that it has meaning to all people at all times. And while we've gone over the creation accounts, there is no way they would have understood relativity. They would have never understood the timeless nature of light, of the relative difference between matter and energy being the same things, just not the same amount of the same thing. We can now. They would never have been able to understand the scientific applications of it, but they could certainly understand Yah creating the world for the purpose of his communion relationship. Right, right. So, with the creation account, nomadic Hebrews could get something from it and understand it. And the most advanced physicists today can get something from it and understand it. Perhaps the ambiguity in the wording exists for a reason. Yahudi of Moshe's day could see it as an exemption to the instruction regarding certain animals, slaughtered animals, to the tabernacle, something that would have meaning to them at that point, and we today can see it applying to eating clean and unclean foods, something that to them would have made no difference, but for us today does. The unusual word order here was throwing me off for a while, but with this in mind, this all makes sense to me. What do you think? And my response was, I concur completely. But that's the right process to go through. There are is there a likelihood, JB, or Larry, you're listening here, and William, is there a likelihood that this could mean more than an exemption on what we can eat, more than an exemption of what we bring to the tent of the witness for the purpose of a sacrifice for a reconciling offering, that more than just an exemption on hygiene? Is there the possibility, if not the likelihood, that there is more to this that we're not seeing?
I think I don't think this is the first time he's made this exemption.
Yeah.
I've been digging around a little bit. Shemot 34:15 really has me thinking about this because, you know, I wasn't at odds with you. I wasn't in agreement with you. I was just kind of neutral and just trying to figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I don't see anything wrong with that.
No.
But when I look at Yosef as well, you know, I mean, he was pretty much, you know, he had almost as much authority as Pharaoh, and he ate everything they gave him. He was clean shaven and bald headed, but he was still righteous.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. And you know what's interesting about Yosef is that Yosef is not just a fellow that takes up a third of the first book of the Torah. I mean, about a third of the book is devoted to this guy. So there's a reason that a third of the book is devoted to this fellow. And I suspect, my personal conclusion is, I'm not claiming to be right here, I'm just going to give you my thoughts on it, is that he is a prototype for Yahusha. That there are some 20 or 30 aspects of his life that parallel Yahusha. And as such, we benefit by considering everything that is said and done associated with Yosef. And I think you were right, and that he was a righteous man, and yet he ate whatever was put in front of him. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with me, Yada, is you know, obviously I corresponded with you and shared that the exemption part is what threw me off. But in reality, I mean, Yahweh is redundant. And he may explain it in a different way, but in essence, I mean, just like you said about Yosef, you do see the story of Yahusha in that. I'm just saying that I don't think it's an exemption, maybe for that particular circumstance. You know, he was just telling them, hey, just be thoughtful. And I see in 34:15 in Shemot. I mean, I like to try to translate it myself, but, you know, I looked at it, and there they went and they ate the meat that was actually slaughtered, you know. It says that they were whoring and so forth. But then he said, don't forget the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He said, don't do that. You might take their daughters and their sons. And in other words, he, you know, the Yisraelites mixed with the Goyim. But he said, don't forget the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Keep it. Celebrate it.
Attend it, Answer the invitation. No matter how you look at this, it is an exemption. But an exemption is not a contradiction. That is the bottom line here. And are there multiple ways to interpret what Yah has said? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and then here's my last thought on it. I think if we get this, you know, let's say we're wrong. I really don't think Yah is going to keep us out of coming home. He's going to let us in the house. I mean, we're really trying. We're trying to figure this out.
Right.
You know, we all sincerely love him. We all sincerely want the Torah written on our hearts.
Yosha said, a man is not defiled by what goes into his mouth, but what comes out of his mouth. And so you are absolutely correct.
And it's so important it's never mentioned again.
You know,
by the way,
this is not a spiritual issue. This is a physical, mortal issue. Now, if the exemption is as JB suggests, then it is a spiritual issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is food to be consumed, then it is a physical, mundane issue where the instruction has absolutely evolved over time, but an exemption is not a contradiction.
Well, one thing I want to mention, when it's important, one of the things that, he'll put an apostrophe on it. I've seen it time and time again. And that apostrophe will be, and this is for all places and all times.
Oh, right. Right.
And all generations.
Right. Yeah, he didn't say that with their food instructions. Right. He didn't say that.
No,
with
he did not.
No.
Yeah, it's like I've talked with someone else about this before, and if Yahweh said never eat these animals, that'd be one thing. If he said like he does with circumcision, eat these animals and you have negated my covenant, then we'd be having a whole different discussion.
It's not
his instructions on the food is still good, guys. I mean, tell you for myself that I eat any kind of shellfish, I'm going to be with Yah sooner than later. I can't.
Shellfish
is
certainly riskier, and previous to the last 10 years, it was insanely risky.
But keep in mind, if you're
with people who are not part of the covenant, and they know you are part of the covenant, and you say, "I'm not going to eat shellfish because the Torah says it's not food," you are taking a bigger risk with their spiritual salvation than you are the risk of eating it for your own physical demise. So there is a risk. There is a risk either way. Now, if it's just you and your wife and your family and everyone is part of the covenant, then by golly, there's no reason to order shellfish.
Can I throw one other thing in here?
Sure. Yeah.
There's another thing going on.
So context here is important, William, and I think that I would keep that in mind. I think there was an absolute reason for Yosha's statement, and that there is a risk associated either way. And one risk is spiritual, the other risk is physical. And the Aaronic blessing says Yahweh is keeping a watchful eye on his children. And so the risk that we take physically is sometimes insignificant to the risk that we might take of miscommunicating the purpose of the Torah being instruction, not law to invade, but instruction to learn from, something that is liberating as opposed to restrictive, and how somebody might misinterpret that. There's a risk associated with that, too, and that's a spiritual risk.
There's just one other thing I want to mention, part of the group running around, demeaning your translations and demeaning us for agreeing with those translations, they're using Yasha Yahu, context is everything, where he talks about these pots of pork, and you being an abomination. They are using the word abomination for anybody that eats a piece of bacon with their egg. They are way, way out of line on that.
Because what he's
talking about there is the Easter celebration, because he doesn't just talk about the pots of pork. He talks about the candles lit. It's obviously religious ceremonies.
Ham is a big part of Tammuz, the weeping for Tammuz. He was allegedly killed by a wild boar, so the Easter ham is in celebration of Tammuz being gored by the wild boar, and it's become, the Easter ham is ubiquitous with the holiday, and so
see several spots in the prophets, especially where it uses eating unclean foods as a reference to Torahlessness. But again, to me, that goes back to quite simply, it's not talking about literally the food they're eating, but it's talking about the religious bullshit, I'm going to use the word, that they're ingesting.
Right.
And that's what they're, I think that is much more what is being meant there.
Yeah, I do too. But, I think collectively have taken Dode's perspective on the Torah. We've accepted Dode's perspective on the Torah, which is it's to be observed in the sense of closely examined and carefully considered, to be understood so that we can execute enlightened free will regarding the choices that Yahweh has provided for us. And that is our collective understanding of what it means, and I don't know, I'm not going to fault somebody that wants to apply it literally, so long as they don't get dogmatic about it, and so long as they don't move to the point that the Torah is becoming something that restricts as opposed to liberates.
Yeah, my biggest problem comes when anyone tries to apply their understanding to everyone else. You know, if you want to read this, if you want to, you know, come to the Torah and go, okay, I don't want to eat these because that's what the Torah said, that's fine. But when you start telling other people that they shouldn't eat it or they can't eat it because of the Torah, that's when you start stepping into that realm of religion.
Right.
And I am not comfortable at all
there. That's why I would say even the should that you mentioned, I would quibble with that because there are circumstances where I think the risk of eating pork,
physical,
for example,
risk,
is spiritually on those that are around us is far greater than the risk that the pork is going to negatively affect us. And I think that was the point Yosha was making. I think it's the reason for the exemption. Now, does that mean that there aren't other possible interpretations? Absolutely, there are. I'm not going to deny that. And if you have a different one, like you do, JB, that's fine. That's acceptable. No, it's written to encourage thoughts. And if we all came to exactly the same conclusion on everything, what fun would eternity be?
Yeah.
Really?
There'd be a lot of us sitting around going, oh, you think that? I think that too. Aren't that? That's awesome that we both think that. What about you? Do you think that? I think that.
Yeah, I know. Then, yeah, it wouldn't be any fun.
The best conversations we have with any friends are when we come to areas where we disagree. When we can sit there and debate for hours on a topic, that's a fun night. Tonight has been a great night.
Yeah, it's been a great night. It's been a great night, and I think what we have done is used a less than ideal catalyst as a springboard to a useful discussion on approach. And what I'd like to do next Shabbat, next Friday, if it's all right with everybody, is go into the Aaronic blessing and look at every word in the order they're presented, the stems, the conjugations, and the moods, the potential meanings of the words, and let's translate it together.
I can't wait. This sounds like so much fun.
I think that's fun. And and the thing that I most want to convey is that I'm not a professional. I'm not quick at this. I struggle with it. I have to say, okay, Joseph, that's a third person expression of volition. Who's the third person here? How would we convey that in English? How do I convey the ongoing nature in this particular context of the imperfect? All right, the peel is that the object is influenced by the action of the verb. What does that mean here, and how would I convey that in English? You know, I'm going to tell you, I'm a dunderhead. I'm really methodical on this.
You know,
and I'm hoping
we're only doing this on the fly and doing it an hour and a half a week. I could see these handful of verses taking up the next year's worth of show.
Oh, sure.
And I'm okay with that. I'm not complaining.
But that's okay.
It's
going
to be a while.
to walk through a translation to say, this is the thought process. These are the options. This is how the way these words are shaded. Let's just all go through it together, and you're going to see, okay, it is slow, it's meticulous, it's an art form, there's no right and wrong, but in the end, every nuance is going to resonate. Every nuance, every potential nuance that we can learn is going to enlighten us, it's going to resonate, it's going to be beneficial. even if we only get through six words in an hour and a half.
See a lot.
Yeah.
Wow. That'll be cool.
Yeah. All right, guys. I've actually got a sore throat. I'm really, really, really run down, and it's been 6 hours of radio so far today. So I'm going to sign off. I want to appreciate everyone's contribution. And Larry, I know that this all began with an attack on you, and you were really positive and extraordinarily non-confrontational through all of this, and for you to do that when you were personally attacked in all of this is I appreciate you doing that and not elevating this any more than I probably already have, but I want to thank you for the approach.
I just finally got to the point where I just blocked it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know. I don't care. You know, if somebody wants to think that that these are religious edicts and he's framing a religious foundation, well, go ahead. Go ahead. And you're wrong.
I have given up entirely on the notion that the Torah has anything that is restrictive. I view everything in the Torah as liberating. I even view the conditions to participate in the covenant, which are ironclad. I view each of the conditions to participate in the Torah as awesomely liberating. I don't lose a thing, and I gain everything when I acquiesce to and act upon the conditions of the covenant. So my whole perspective is Yahweh saved us from bondage, from a human oppression, and that he is the one that liberates us.
That's his perspective, by the way. He says it over and over and over.
Yeah, well, that's the goal. If our perspective is consistent with his perspective, then we have the right perspective.
That's right.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's
what I think is his perspective. That's what I think is the Torah's purpose, is to liberate us, not to restrict us.
I would ask you, how much would you say of the Talmud is food laws?
Oh, wow. It's huge.
High percentage.
Between the food laws and the Shabbat laws and the laws on personal hygiene of what you can, like you can't, an Orthodox, you can't touch a goyim. I would say that the laws on the subjects around what we're talking about here, clean and unclean, is probably, between the three, is probably a quarter of it.
Does Yahweh say anything good about the Talmud ever?
Oh, boy, did he ever tear it apart. No. You know, in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, he doesn't say anything about the Talmud because it didn't even exist until after the last book, Malachi, was written. But Yosha sure does.
And Malachi was pretty rough on it, though. I mean, he didn't say Talmud, but he said your teaching and instructions, talking to the clerics.
Yeah, he did. And Yashayah, prophetically, Yashayah is filled with denunciations of the teachings by rote of the ancestors, which is basically the oral law. So it's referenced prophetically, but not under the name Talmud. You're right. It's there all
over
the place.
He says your teachings and instructions.
Yeah, which you memorized by rote. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, no, you're right. I stand corrected. No, you're right.
In Malachi, I mean, he even says, because you do all this, you've basically taken the family covenant and you've turned it into nonsense. And for that, I'm going to see you and your ancestors spread all over the world with bullshit smeared all over your faces. That's what he says.
Yeah, that's what he says.
That's pretty tough stuff.
Said. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, I'm going to run. I hope that that this was as useful, as positive, as uplifting, as beneficial for everybody. As you know, now that we're two and a quarter hours through it, something I was dreading, I now feel quite good about. I hope that we dealt with this issue in a useful way.
Yeah,
I hope
we should have been more civilized, but you know, we got through it, and that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, guys.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we have to be careful what we write when we're being critical of translations of Yahweh's testimony. You just need to be a considerably more careful in that regard.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah, because what
that's
you end up doing is that you have something that stays forever on the internet, and somebody trying coming across Yada Yah or Intro to God or questioning Paul, and then sees that somebody who is an insider says that these translations always mislead and they always confuse, and that's not going to be good.
It seems to me that going to the oldest usage of the word would be the most correct way to do it.
That's my favorite. But.
Well, that's what I would think.
Yeah.
Because I hear people today, when they say Torah, they say law. When they say Shamar, they say obey.
Yeah.
And on, then come to find out none of these things are real.
You know, when Yahweh defines his own terms and he uses Yara to define Torah, and he does, when he introduces Torah, he uses Yara to define it. And Yara clearly means source from which teaching and direction and guidance flow. At that point, I think you're on pretty good ground if you accept Yahweh's definitions of his terms.
And you need to always circle back and remember, you know, even like myself, when I was struggling, I had to come back and remember and say, hey, this is my dad. He's not a religious deity. And that's something Larry's always pointing out.
Right.
And that's true.
My dad.
And that's, So you know, when you keep that in mind and you don't lose sight of that, then, you know, it makes it easier to get through the garbage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, this is Daddy. He's focused on me. He's paying very close attention to me. He loves me, and he's doing everything he can to liberate, enlighten, and uplift me. He's not working against
me.
He's working with me, for me.
Imagine from his perspective, and I'm going to let you go because I know you have a headache. But imagine from his perspective, he says the whole way through his words, "Look what the clerics have done. They've stolen my. They've taken the words, and they've exalted themselves with my words, and they've twisted my words, and I hate religion." I mean, he says it all the way through. He says it all the way through. All the way through. All the way through. All the way through. And then somebody gets angry because their security blanket, which is really a major pillar in rabbinic Judaism, has been taken away from them. That's the way I viewed it. And I don't need security blankets like that. That's not where I'm at.
I want liberation. But you know, we can't. And I'm going to use a collective we. Most of us have taken a very liberating, enlightening perspective on the Torah. You know, we view the Torah as guidance.
It's not a religious document.
That liberates us.
It is not a religious document. I'm 100% on that.
Yeah. It's not a restrictive document.
That's right.
It's an invitation to be part of Yahweh's family, to get to know him and to spend eternity with him. And it's an invitation that guides us through that process. And every aspect of it is designed to be educational or liberating. All right, guys. Good night. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.